Welcome to November's AZM Cast. Kevin Riley and Lisa Chan, this one's for you.
That's great. It starts with an earthquake. Birds and snakes and airplane. Lenny Bruce is not afraid. I have a hurricane. Listen to yourself. Churn world serves its own needs. Dummy serve your own needs. Beat it up an ox. Speak grunt. No strength. The ladder starts to clatter with fear. Bite down. High. Patriotic. Patriotic. Slam. Bite. Bright. Light. Feel it. Pretty sight.
Welcome to November's edition of AZMcast. The epic transition has come and gone, and I, for one, have to say that it went pretty smooth. Big ups to Kevin and Lisa for doing such a great job and for continuing to do a good job. Although Epic still recognizes me as a resident instead of an attending, as do most of the nurses and techs and other attendings. So maybe Epic's not too far behind. I want to thank Jared Mosier for putting together most of this stuff. I have two board exams that I've been trying to put together in the last 4 weeks, so thanks, Jared, for doing that. We're going to do Palm this month, and Jared has lots of Palm goodness for you guys since he is a Palm expert. Experto. He has talked with Sage Whitmore about ABGs. He has talked with one of our chest radiologists, Dr. Isabel Olivas, about chest radiology. And we're also going to talk a little bit about, with our case managers and our social workers, because even though they sit all next to each other and they all seem to be associated with the bowl of candy, they actually have different jobs. I was as shocked as you were.
All right, so I'm here with Sage. Somebody asked for Sage's pearls on ABGs since this is pulmonary month. So Sage Whitmore, take it away.
All right, so I'm going to do this in exactly five steps, but I'm sure if there's a sixth step, you'll hear it from Jared in just a second. So here's some ABG interpretation in exactly five steps. So step number one, the pH always indicates a primary disorder. There's no real trickery with an ABG. If you've got a low pH, you have a primary acidosis. If you've got a high pH, you have a primary alkalosis. There's no such thing as overcompensation when it comes to the ABG. So you'll never see somebody blow off an acidosis to the point of having a pH of 7.5 or vice versa. So the pH always indicates a primary disorder. Second point is the relationship of the pH and the PCO2 tells you whether that primary disorder is metabolic or respiratory. What do I mean by that? I mean that if the pH and the PCO2 move in the same direction, then you have a primary metabolic disorder. Again, if the pH and the PCO2 move in the same direction, it's a primary metabolic disorder. So what's an example? If you got a patient with a pH of 7.20 and a PCO2 of 20, well, those two numbers have both changed in the same direction, right? They're both lower than they should be. And since the pH and PCO2 have both changed in the same direction, that's a primary metabolic acidosis.
I think an easy way to think about that is your body is either losing bicarb or it's taking on something, metabolizing something that's making you kick out bicarb. So as your pH drops, your bicarb's going to drop.
Perfect. Conversely, if your pH and your PCO2 change in a different direction or opposite directions, that is a primary respiratory disorder. Again, if the pH and the PCO2 are moving in the opposite direction, it's a primary respiratory disorder. And what do I mean by that? Let's take that patient again with a pH of 7.20, but now he's got a PCO2 of 65. All right, the pH has gone down. The CO2 has gone up. This is a primary respiratory acidosis. Okay, and if you flip those around, say a pH of 7.50 and a PCO2 of 25, that's a primary respiratory alkalosis. Okay, rule number three, the acuity of a respiratory acidosis depends on the 10 to 0.08 rule. All right, the acuity of your respiratory acidosis depends on the 10 to 0.08 rule. What do I mean by that? If a patient stops breathing suddenly, either is asphyxiating, has an opiate overdose, you smother him with a pillow one way or another, their carbon dioxide is going to start to rise acutely.
Those of you that like to learn by doing, please do not smother your patient with a pillow and then check an ABG. Just take Sage's word for it.
That rate of rise varies on depending what you read, but probably within the first minute or so, the PCO2 will rise somewhere around 8, maybe 10 points, and then maybe 3 or 4 points every minute after that. There's some tables. But what you need to know is that in acute respiratory failure, for every 10 in PCO2 rise, the pH should drop by 0.08. So what does that look like? Your blood gas right now is 7.4 and 40. If you stop breathing in a couple minutes, it's going to be 7.32 and 50. In another few minutes, it's going to be 7.24 and 60. So if that makes sense, for every 10 in PCO2 rise, your pH should drop by 0.08. And that tells you that it's an acute respiratory acidosis. If you see a marked rise in your PCO2, but your pH just hasn't moved that much, that's your clue that this is a chronic respiratory acidosis. Maybe somebody with COPD, for example, or obesity hypoventilation syndrome. All right, so that was point three, is remember acuity is the 10 to 0.08 rule. Number four, one of my favorite pet peeves, the PaO2, the partial pressure of arterial oxygen, is a diagnostic test. It does not tell you how to treat the patient. So in other words, if you get an arterial blood gas and you've got a PaO2 of 50 and your respiratory therapist wants to turn up the oxygen on the ventilator, you have to ask her what the saturations are, all right? Distal tissues don't care about the arterial O2. It carries no weight. Your tissues get oxygen off the hemoglobin molecule. They care what the O2 saturation is. So for example, if I've got a patient on a ventilator satting 95%, I don't really care if his PaO2 is 55, 75, 105. It doesn't really affect anything for me treatment-wise.
That point brings up the classic ABG versus VBG debate. So, okay, I won't steal your thunder. Go ahead.
Yeah, told you to do it in five. Here we go. Number five, relationship of ABG to VBG. So depending on what you read, the relationship of ABG to VBG is pretty tight in a normal patient with excellent hemodynamics. The pH on a venous gas is usually within 0.02 to 0.05 of an arterial pH, and the PCO2 is usually within about 5. So what does that mean? So you guys sitting there listening have an arterial gas of 7.4 and 40, and you've got a venous gas of 7.38 and 45, okay? But that relationship is markedly distorted for a patient in shock. And the worse that somebody's perfusion and hemodynamics are, the more disparate you'll see those numbers, to the point where they may not even look like they came from the same patient. So VBG is not a great substitute for an ABG in the patient with hemodynamic compromise, which...
Yeah, I agree with that. My mantra is, if you want to know what somebody's PCO2 or pH are, VBG is fine. The reason being that the arterial pH or the arterial PCO2 are not going to be lower than that. But if you want to know what somebody's oxygenation is, you need an ABG, because it could be very close to the VBG if the extraction is pretty low, or it could be much higher than the VBG if you're in shock and you're extracting a ton. So the ABG still holds some relevance in the emergency department. Good. Thank you very much.
So we get into this argument. Let's call it a discussion. Let's call it a disagreement with admitting services all the time of whether or not they want an ABG. And we say, I'm not going to assault my patient with an ABG. I'm just going to get you a VBG. And we've got the set. No big deal. They make an excellent point on that fifth point of when an ABG actually is the important test to get. That's what they actually want to know. Excellent summary by Sage of something that, even though it seems like it's a medical student topic and maybe we shouldn't be covering this in residency, in the heat of the moment when you're trying to interpret that VBG or ABG, you really have to have this stuff down. It has to be like clockwork. It has to be like a muscle memory that you can spout this off and figure out what to do about what you've now interpreted on that gas. Great job, guys. Jared's now going to talk to Isabel Olivas, who's one of our chest radiologists. She's starting this year, and Jared has some excellent questions, some very pertinent questions in the emergency department of what we're looking for when we're getting some of these chest CTs. What about these chest MRIs we're starting to do now? New and exciting things that we're doing to try to find the badness in the chest that we're always worried about, because all of our patients have chest pain if you dig far enough.
All right, so I'm here with Dr. Isabel Oliva. She is the, you're the head of thoracic imaging, right?
Cardiothoracic.
And you're new here. You came from Beck East?
Yeah, it was, I trained at the Brigham for 4 years and then Yale. I was a faculty at Yale for 3 years before joining in February.
Well, it's great to have you here, and thanks for joining us. So I wanted to talk to you about a couple things. The first is any comments that you have or tips that you have on reading chest imaging for the EM resident?
So, yeah, let me go over not just chest imaging, but any imaging in general. What I tell the residents when they start as first years is to have a system to make sure you look at everything, like a checklist, so you don't forget to look at anything. You only see what you look for, and I tell them to study because you only look for what you know. So you have to know what you're looking for and look for it to see it. It's not like a rib fracture is going to pop up to you like that. So there is no right and wrong system, just have your own system. So for example, myself, I start in the chest wall, you look at the subcutaneous tissues, the bones, then you can go inside, look at the lungs for any infiltrate or for any pulmonary edema or things like that. Then you look at the pleural space, superiorly for pneumo, inferiorly for pleural effusion. Then you go into the mediastinum, you have the airway, the trachea, bronchi. Then you look at the heart and the great vessels, and that gives you an overview if there is anything. And for CT, it's the same thing, it's just a little more, especially chest CT or abdominal CT. Sometimes you have a big, let's say you have bilateral multifocal airspace disease, and we have what it's called satisfaction of search. So when you see the problem, you feel satisfied and you stop looking. So I always tell the residents, if you see something very abnormal, you note that, but then you go and look for everything else. Because then you may miss a bone metastasis because you got caught up on the lung. Or you may miss a mediastinal mass. And the same thing on the belly. Sometimes you have this big bowel obstruction and you forgot to check the adrenals and the other things. So I think that's the main thing. Have a system, a checklist, and make sure you look at everything, especially if something's really abnormal. Go back to that later.
I had a pulmonology professor in medical school that used to show the same x-ray to stump everybody. He used to say that your mind automatically goes to the bright, shiny object, and so you pick up the mass or the pneumonia and you miss the humeral head fracture.
Exactly.
Do you have any mnemonics that you go by? I learned, are there many lung lesions when I was in school?
For those of you that, like me, did not learn that helpful mnemonic in school, are there many lung lesions is a mnemonic standing for abdomen, looking for a normal air bubble or evidence of free air, thorax, to evaluate the bones and the soft tissues, mediastinum, lungs bilaterally, to look for the gross difference in density between both lungs, and then lungs unilaterally, to look for anything there. Are there many lung lesions? And in response to Jared's other comment, yes, my mind and my eyes gravitate toward shiny objects.
If you have airspace disease, right, all that means is the alveoli are filled with something except air. And I had a teacher in Brazil who used to say the lungs are really stupid. They react the same way by imaging. So they look white no matter what's there. So the most important thing is how acute it is. So priors are your best friend. I keep telling the residents that. If something is new, it's acute, then you think pus, water, blood that are filling the alveoli. So pneumonia, edema, hemorrhage. If it's a chronic airspace disease, then there is a little mnemonics, BALSIE, BALLSIE, which is like bronchoalveolar carcinoma, amiodarone toxicity, L for lymphoma, because some tumors can look as pneumonia. Okay. You have sarcoids, you have inappropriate treatment pneumonia, and I think the E is eosinophilic pneumonia. So are things that you look like pneumonia, you treat the patient and then they don't get better. So you think about other things that may cause in that. And there are several, so it's really hard to. So for example, for upper lobe predominant disease, diseases that happen in the upper lobes more than lower lobes, you have CASSET-P, which is cystic fibrosis, ankylosing spondylitis, sarcoid silicosis, EG, which is pulmonary lung cancer cells, TB, and the P is for PCP. So there are many, and it takes a while to get used to all of that. I can give you some for you to present or put on the website, which most acute ones that you can see in the ED kind of thing.
Yeah, that'd be helpful. Yeah. I think one thing that the EM physician often overlooks are the ARDS mimics.
Yes.
And so, you know, we don't keep those things in mind, like organizing pneumonia, and they don't get
inflammatory infections, yeah. Inflammatory causes.
Yeah.
It's the same thing. It looks the same because it's filling the alveoli, but you have to think about other things that can cause that.
Now, we order a lot of chest CTs to see if somebody has a PE or not. Do you notice a trend in things that maybe we're missing? And you talk about the satisfaction bias. We look, we say no PE, but we miss a mass, or we miss a hilar, parahilar infiltrate.
Well, I think you guys are pretty good, and the residents too. If it's not normal, it's usually visible. I think the main thing that almost everybody misses is rib fractures. So that's one thing. For example, a patient has a chest pain, and the first thing I tell the residents, you have to find a cause. Don't assume there is nothing. Mm-hmm. There has to be something. So let's think what can cause chest pain. PE, aortic dissection, coronary artery disease, pericarditis, pneumothorax, pneumonia, pleural effusion, a splenic infarct. One time a patient came with a lower chest pain, was a splenic infarct. So you have to check the upper abdomen as well. I don't know if cholecystitis, if it's inflamed, can irritate and reflect in the chest, mm-hmm. and vice versa. Things can present differently than it is. And then rib fractures, thoracic spine wedge fractures. You have to look at the thoracic spine on the sagittal or coronal view, because if you look on the axial, it's the same plane as the fracture, so you don't see the height loss. Mm-hmm. But if you look on the lateral one, you can see the vertebral body is really smaller than the adjacent ones. So then when you can't find anything, then you're like, okay, it's normal. But it's actually the hardest thing is in the beginning is to call something normal, because you really, you have to be really confident there's nothing.
Right.
And you look for PE, but you have to look for everything else. And in terms of PE, I always tell the residents to look for PE even if it's not a PE CT. So if you did a PE in an CT, a contrast enhanced, it has to have contrast. Mm-hmm. You do a contrast enhanced for colon cancer. And many times you find PE incidentally. And even though the contrast is not perfect, you can see sometimes.
Now, in terms of using contrast, I often tell the residents, if we're not looking for PE, if we just want to evaluate for pneumonia, we don't need contrast. Don't hit their kidneys with the contrast. I know a lot of people are less worried about the contrast effect. So if in that situation, would you recommend just giving the contrast in case we have overlooked a PE or not?
No, I think you are right. Contrast is a drug, a medication, and like any other, you shouldn't give it unless it's necessary.
Okay.
So the times that you want to give contrast is if you're looking for the vessels, aorta, pulmonary arteries, coronaries, the heart chambers itself, or if you're looking for mediastinal pathology, lymphadenopathy, a mass, anything like that, because it really delineates the structure as well. Mm-hmm. If you're looking for lung pathology only, they do not need contrast.
Okay.
Yeah, and they'll be extra.
What is your take? You do mostly cardiac imaging, right?
Cardiothoracic.
So, two things. One, what is your take on the triple rule out?
Yeah, I actually gave a presentation last year on the Society of Thoracic Radiology meeting about triple rule out, and it is a little controversial. So the first thing is, you have to understand, if you are imaging the pulmonic circulation versus the systemic circulation, you have to time it to that. So you give usually 70 cc's of contrast, and you inject, so let's say I give 100 cc's, and I inject at 5 cc's per second, so that gives me 20 seconds to image. And I think the difference between the pulmonic and systemic circulation is going to be about 18 seconds to go one to the other. Mm-hmm. So you can't do both perfectly. Mm-hmm. So you have to choose, because your bolus is going to move and it's going to be away.
Right.
So that's the story. If you do a triple rule out, you need more contrast. So you need to increase the dose or decrease the ratio, mm-hmm. of injection. Mm-hmm. Decreasing the ratio is not good because we do a high rate. Not ratio, sorry, rate. We do a high rate injection because you want a lot of contrast there to be really bright. Mm-hmm. So if you want to image the pulmonic circulation, the systemic circulation and the coronaries, which take about 5 seconds from the aorta to fill. You need more, you need like 140 cc's. So you always have to think about risks and benefits. The other thing is radiation. So any gated study has more radiation than non-gated. Mm-hmm. Then the question comes, so when we're doing a coronary only, so your radiation is going to depend on the amount you give and how much you scan in length. So if you're doing a coronary CTA, when you only care about the coronary arteries, we don't scan the whole chest to spare radiation. You do from the carina to the bottom of the heart. And this, you gain the Z-axis. So if you're going to do a triple rule out, I'm going to have to scan the whole chest because you need to look at the branch of the pulmonary arteries all the way from the top to bottom. So that already doubles my radiation. So those are the main two things against a triple rule out is the radiation and the contrast load. So if you really, the best thing is if you can differentiate, what am I really concerned about? Is it a PE or is it coronary or aorta?
Yeah.
And if you can't at all, then I guess you can do it, but you have to weigh the risks and benefits.
But I think the one situation where it would be useful is the patient that comes in, has got chest pain radiating to the back, it's tearing, they're hypertensive. It sounds like you would say we need to choose whether we think it's a dissection or we think it's a PE and try to gate it towards that rather than doing a triple rollout.
Right.
Sorry to keep butting in on this talk, but Chris Davis and I just had a patient last night, came in, sudden onset chest pain, radiating to the back, was on birth control, had a family history of sudden cardiac death, and we had a hard time trying to figure out which one are we going to scan. Are we going to look for the PE or are we going to look for the dissection? She was tacky to the 130s, 150s, just looked awful, and we had to hurry up and make a decision. So in talking with the radiologist a little bit further, in helping make that decision, which one are you going to do? With most PE studies, you'll get a fairly good look at the proximal aorta. That's just part of what you do, because you're going to get some runoff that's going to go to the lungs, come back, and quickly go out the aorta at whatever your blood pressure is. When you look for dissection, you're going to miss a lot of the runoff that's still in the lungs looking for PE. So my opinion, my two cents would be, if you're not sure, err on the side of looking for a PE, which is going to be a little more tough to find, and hope that the runoff shows you the proximal portion of the dissection. So that's what we decided to do, and ultimately when we got the scan done, we found nothing. And we still don't know what's wrong with this girl.
That would be more like a dissection, I guess, right? Mm. Radiating to the back and hypertension. And then you have to look into hypercoagulable states and is the patient. Sometimes, I mean, I know I loved doing ED when I was a med student, actually. It's pretty exciting. But I couldn't do forever, but I really like doing a little bit of it. And it's hard. You have all these patients. You have little time.
Yeah.
And you have to make decisions quick. Patients are huge. You don't get a good physical exam. You can auscultate anything. And you don't know what to do. And they have no history of bad historians. But you try to narrow either to the one of the circulations at least. You could do a coronary that extends to the arch. The contrast wouldn't be that much. The radiation is a little higher. Mm-hmm. But a triple rollout is much more of both.
Okay. Last question is, when we're trying to look for a PE, we typically get the PE study, CT scan, and then we Doppler the legs. What is your take on MRI, and how, when you do a runoff, how far down do you go?
So the protocol that we have developed here is to do, so first thing to leave clear, it's we don't do MRI PE routinely, right? It's more like a backup plan. So for people who have allergy to iodinated contrast, mm-hmm. or who people are really young and you have a low pretest probability, so you spare the radiation. Pregnant patients for sure. And allergies or renal diseases. So there's two protocols. One is without contrast, which is a little more limited, and one is with contrast. In both of them, we do the pelvis. And the good thing about that ultrasound doesn't go as deep into the pelvis. Mm-hmm. Ultrasound does mostly the calves and a little in the thighs. What we scan on the MRI is the pelvis and the thighs. Things up to the knee.
Okay.
So, but you don't see the small vessels in the calf.
Right. You don't on ultrasound either.
Yeah, exactly. You try to, but you don't.
Yeah. So I would say it's probably a perfect study for a pregnant patient because most of their DVTs come from the left iliac, which you're not going to see on ultrasound anyway.
And so, yeah, and then talking about downsides of having a MRP, the only one that people have brought up, and it makes sense, so it's a little less sensitive than CT. It's about 86 to 90% sensitivity. It's 100% specific. And there was the PioPad 3 that looked at MRI, but they were doing only one sequence, one type of sequence. What we do is three sequences, two without contrast and one post-contrast. So the pregnant only get two sequences. Yeah. So with the three of them, you increase your sensitivity. And with the pelvis and thighs, if you don't have a DVT, the chances are very low that you will have a PE. The downside that most of the pulmonologists don't like is because you look at the lungs on MRI, and we're not there yet for the lungs. But if you think about it, how many people that you see on the ED really going to have lung disease and before afterward? Maybe one in 50. Right. So I don't see that as much as a problem.
In Tucson, it becomes an issue with all these Coxey nodules, and what do you do about the nodules, and how do you have them follow up?
Yeah, we're trying to apply for a trial, a grant, to do MRI in nodules, because right now you see a nodule on CT, and the recommendation is to follow them by CT every year, every 6 months, which is radiation costs, or to do a biopsy, which is invasive. So we're trying to see, me with Dr. Garland from lung cancer, from oncology, if we can do an MRI and look at the characteristics. So CT is a morphologic, it's a static, one snapshot. Mm-hmm. With MRI, you can inject the contrast and see it going into the nodule, and you can look at the kinetics of the nodule and the permeability. So we're interested in seeing if a nodule from infection would behave differently than a nodule from cancer. Hmm. They have done that in breast cancer to try to differentiate and see how malignant it is.
It'd be great for all those ones that are difficult to get to.
Right. The biopsies are hard to do. And people get anxious. You have to wait 3 months to know if you have a cancer or not.
Right.
If you can know right away and spare all that, they'll be
especially
great.
Here when they're almost all coxy.
Everybody. I'm going to get coxy if I don't have already. It's amazing.
Well, do you have any last words?
No, keep up the good work. You guys work hard, and we appreciate that. And we are always here. I mean, I'm 24 hours on call for cardiac and for chest. If you have any questions, you can always page me. And we have a good team.
Well, thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Anytime.
So I have lots of residents ask me now, Leach, what's it like to be an attending? You're the big attending now. How's life as an attending? Well, it's kind of like... Stained ball gown, stretching the hotel room. Crystal Maybach, diamonds on your timepiece. Jet planes, islands, tigers on a gold leash. Which is great and all, but sometimes it's more like... But, you know, overall, it's pretty good. So I'm here with one of our awesome social workers and one of our awesome case managers, and I'm going to discuss a time-honored tradition, which is the difference between social work and case management. We sit them next to each other, which is probably a mistake because it makes them blend together, even though they do completely different jobs. To try to make it easier, they've actually posted a piece of paper above where they sit that says what they do. But because we're emergency doctors, we just try to ask someone else, and we try to figure it out from there. So what I'm going to do is ask someone else. I'm going to ask Carol, one of our social workers, what it is that she is responsible for, what it is that she does to help us out so wonderfully, besides just take the history on the psych patient we don't feel like talking to anymore. Carol?
Well, besides delivering candy every morning.
Thank you for that, by the way.
To all the ED residents and staff. Social workers basically deal with madness, mayhem, and misery. We will assist you with your psych transfers and your psych patients getting medications for them. We do all of your hospice referrals and transfers. We deal with domestic violence, assault, child abuse and neglect, vulnerable adults, substance abuse, your sexual assaults, We do services with traumas. We go in with the families and provide support and communication between the families and the physicians. We deal with bereavement support, homelessness, lack of medical resources, transportation issues, advanced directives, and locating family and next of kin for patients or traumas that are deceased. We are happy always to go in with physicians when there has been a death and be support to the family and take care of all of the bereavement packets that we provide families after someone is deceased. And we could probably help you find or locate services. If we don't provide them ourselves, we could probably direct you to the correct people.
So what you're saying is you do not do inpatient versus observation, PTOT home health, durable medical equipment, prior authorization, SNF placements, or medical transport. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Because that's the piece of paper that's sitting above the case manager's desk, correct?
Correct.
After 5 years, I finally figured this out. It took a piece of paper and a nice little mnemonic. I love that. Madness, mischief, and mayhem, and misery. So if you can think of anything that you don't want to deal with because it's too socially awkward, that's what our wonderful social workers do. So now I have one of our case managers, Kathy, who is going to tell us from the case management side what she does. When we come to bother you about something, what is it that we can actually bother you about that you can help us with? Even though I've found you've been pretty helpful on pretty much anything I bothered you about.
Basically, we're going to look at anything medical. So we start with what the particular patient needs. And if we're talking about a possible admission, it's inpatient versus observation. We can help guide as far as payer reimbursement and which direction to go with that, options for not admitting to the hospital. Any type of discharge needs or home needs can also be asked of us. We can look at what the patient's resources are and guide in that direction. If they have none, what we as a hospital or institution or as a department can help with, and also what their particular insurance or payer source can. So that includes medications, durable medical equipment, skilled nursing placement if they needed something, and if that's a possibility out of the emergency department, acute rehab, long-term facilities, long-term acute care hospitalization, and then any type of assist for transfers to another facility, such as Phoenix, Barrows, any of that sort of thing. So, and then there's just the blanket, et cetera, at the bottom of our list, which means there's no harm in asking us anything, because we'll certainly be happy to try and find the answer to any questions.
So if I have a patient that's come over from a SNF and they need, we've work them up, everything's fine, they need to go back to their SNF, and they need a stretcher van or some kind of assistance to get back. We're not going to be able to put them in a taxi and send it back to their SNF. I talk to you, right?
Correct, yeah. We're definitely the ones involved with that.
If I have a patient that drank too much last night and was found on the bus stop and now is sober and wants to go home and needs a voucher, I talk to social work, correct?
You can talk to social worker, but if they're not there, we'll also assist with that.
Be careful what you wish for.
Yeah.
Now, one other thing that's come up a lot is trying to find, trying to get medications for patients that need it. Like a patient that really needs moxifloxacin for antibiotics, but they're not sick enough to stay inpatient. If I need to try to figure out a prescription for them, even through one of our funds, who would I talk to about that?
Case management, definitely.
Good. All right. Is there? You were mentioning earlier that there's a little bit of overlap between what you guys do. Where do you see the majority of the overlap between what you do and what social work does?
It would be rides, the medicine, and community resources. There's always those overlaps.
Great. All right. Anything else that you can you want to say to try to help out our residents and our faculty as we're trying to navigate who we go to for help?
No, I think if you keep the madness and mayhem in mind and versus medicine, then you know you'll figure out who to talk to.
Awesome, thank you, Carol. Do you have anything else you'd like to say besides any request for candy?
Just ask the question. We'll help you find the answer.
You ladies are awesome. Thank you so much. I really can't give enough credit to our social workers and our case managers for everything that they do for us. To kind of summarize, I think the best way that I've figured it out is if it's something that I need help with because I don't understand it, like it's a systems issue, physical therapy setup, SNF, outpatient versus inpatient, that's a case management issue. You're trying to get somebody their Lovenox so that they can go home and have outpatient therapy. On the other hand, if I need help with something because my patient just had the worst day of their life, or the family dynamics are so awful that it's something I really don't want to spend any more time with, that's when I call my social workers. And that's not to say that I dump on our social workers, but they do such a better job than I think we do a lot of times. They are much better trained for it than we are. They do us the courtesy of calling CPS, of calling Adult Protective Services, of calling and discussing with the psych facilities and the police. They do this as a courtesy. This is not something that they necessarily have to do, but it's something that they do very, very well. So please thank them. And what I used to do back when we had kids and adults mixed in the ED is I would do cute kid consults for our social workers. Because how many times do you come up to them and say, this person wants to hang himself, this person is abusing their child, and this person just lost a loved one? I like to come up every once in a while and say, would you go see room 48? The kid's just really cute. They appreciate it. Well, that's all we have for November. Short and sweet, to the point. I think you guys are all doing a wonderful job with Epic. Thank Kevin and Lisa again for how they're trying to make our system better. And just a couple things that I've picked up from the few shifts that I've worked, both by myself and with the residents. Macros are awesome. Templates are awesome. Please read your template. The patient that you intubated did not come in no acute distress, even though that's what your template says. Before you sign your note, read through it, glance through it, and make sure that the stuff that's supposed to auto-import actually did. There's a lot of empty vitals or empty labs where that's something that we actually want to have in our note. And as far as the real-time charting goes, you guys are doing a great job of doing stuff piecemeal, trying to get stuff ready, getting the charts done so that they don't stack up to 50, 100 charts in only a matter of days. You're doing a wonderful job with it. Keep it up. I think once we all get used to this system, it's going to smoothly flow, and your productivity and your ability to get out of there on time is going to increase. I hope everyone has a wonderful Thanksgiving. I hope you all enjoy the rest of your November. And I promise when December comes around, we're going to have some really good stuff because lots of people have been sending in ideas. Lots of people have been sending in requests. So we're going to try to get those requests done, and enjoy your Turkey Day.